Since the start of the pandemic, scientists have identified thousands of genetic mutations in the virus that causes COVID-19. We're talking about what mutation means for community spread and contagiousness. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW researchers are cataloging and sequencing genomes to understand what COVID looks like from one community to the next. What do you want to know about how it has spread in Wisconsin? Are you heeding the governor's plea to stay home and not venture out? What is the best tactic to limit the spread? We're at 800-642-1234. Dave O'Connor is a UW Medical Foundation professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks, Kate.
So when a virus enters our body, it finds a cell to inject its genetic material into. It finds that host cell, and the virus has to adapt and stay stealthy and a step ahead of our immune system. What are you discovering in how the virus mutates with samples you're looking at?
Well, when people hear the word mutate, they usually think of something that's really bad and dangerous. But in the case of the coronavirus, the virus is typically really, really stable. It has about 30,000 letters in its genome, and we can read those like a book. And every time the virus infects someone new, it's like someone has to type those letters out onto a page. And, you know, they might occasionally make a mistake. They might type a Y when they mean to type a T. And that creates a change that often doesn't change the behavior of the virus in any way, but allows us to compare those different sequences of letters to understand how the virus is spreading.
You know, some new terminology we armchair epidemiologists have been learning is about drift, about neutral drift, these random genetic changes that don't exactly help or hurt the virus. What kind of drift are you seeing around Wisconsin with the samples you're looking at?
Yeah, so early on in the epidemic, what we saw when we compared viruses from Dane County and Milwaukee County is two really important things. The first is that the viruses that were in Dane County sort of stayed in Dane County, and the same thing for the viruses in Milwaukee. So we didn't see viruses with these genetic signatures of Dane County in Milwaukee or vice versa. The other thing that we can do, since we can count how many of these changes occur over time, is we can use that to estimate how much transmission has been going on, because the more transmission, the more drift, the more of these sorts of changes you're going to see. And what we found was that after Governor Evers' Safer at Home order went into effect on March 25th, the amount of drift slowed down substantially in both Dane and Milwaukee counties, which provides another indication that that sort of stay-at-home order really did have an effect on transmission.
Do you know how that has changed since the stay-at-home order was struck down in May, or how our movements have affected what you're seeing with the virus?
Sure. So we've continued sequencing viruses from these communities since then, and now we see that more there's more mixing of the viral signatures. We see signatures that were once only seen in Madison, in Milwaukee, and vice versa, and then we're starting to see new signatures showing up in Madison and Milwaukee, which probably are coming from other parts of the state that haven't had very much sequencing done, but they look sort of just different and foreign to us, so that they're coming from somewhere else. And, you know, all the signs point to what you can see if you look out the window, which is that, you know, the virus is spreading without, you know, much of a firebreak. And people are a lot more mobile now than they were at the very start of the epidemic.
Dave O'Connor, professor of pathology and laboratory medicine with us, UW School of Medicine, Public Health. We're discussing the mutation of the virus that causes COVID-19 and steps to help prevent the spread. You can join in with your questions, what you're seeing in your community. What do you want to know about how COVID has spread in Wisconsin over the last 8 months? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dave, the body's immune system can learn from previous viral encounters and become immune to reinfection. Could the mutation that you're seeing weaken the power of antibodies?
So it's a good question. In fact, one of my buddies from grade school emailed me yesterday and said that he had heard from his doctor that this could be a possibility. And I want to reassure people that there's no evidence that that's happening. The virus makes these small little typos in its genome, if you will, and most of them are, just signatures that we can read out to track the virus. There has not been substantial evidence for changes in the virus that would change its susceptibility to antibodies or would counteract the effectiveness of vaccines. That isn't to say that in 5 or 10 years those sorts of changes might occur and become a problem, but there is no evidence that that's happening yet.
So you're doing all this cataloging and sequencing of the genomes to understand really essentially the source of outbreaks. Is that where this, these libraries can help?
Yeah, so it's sort of like viral detective work, where you're kind of trying to figure out where the virus has been, and then you can compare the viruses to make some projections about where it's going.
Where is it going?
Well, right now it seems to be going everywhere because just not a whole lot that's going to stand in the way of its spread. We seem to be seeing just unfettered spread. And as we sequence more and more viruses, the fact that we keep picking up new and different viruses in our communities that we haven't necessarily seen before means that these viruses are coming in from other places, and that means that people are traveling and seeing other people and getting infected with viruses from other places, or other people are coming here infecting people. And this is happening certainly, statewide and countrywide right now, and it doesn't bode well for the next couple of months.
As you are well aware, there are studies flying every which direction, everywhere. And there was one out of UT Austin in recent weeks that found the virus that causes the disease's accumulating genetic mutation, and one of which may make it more contagious. Can you speak to that? Are we looking at something more contagious here?
Well, there has been one change in the virus that seems to have come from viruses that were originally found in Asia that differs from viruses that were circulating early on in Europe. And viruses that have that European variant have largely displaced the viruses that have the Asian variant. And there is some indication that that Asian variant might be slightly more transmissible, but I think the verdict on how much of an effect that has, is still out. So, you might have variants that have subtle effects on transmission, but again, it's important to emphasize that, there's no solid evidence that those viruses are more severe or more likely to cause severe disease than other viruses. Right now, we think there's mainly just, genetic signatures that we can use to track the viruses. They don't tell you too much about the biology.
Okay. UW Pathology and Laboratory Medicine Professor Dave O'Connor is breaking down how the virus that causes COVID is changing what we should know about community spread and testing. Have you been able to find local testing when you need it? Did you get speedy results? Did you talk with a contact tracer? Are you worried about letting your guard down at a time when the virus is surging and hospitals are maxed out? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dave O'Connor here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing how the virus that causes COVID-19 is mutating and what testing can do to curb transmission, staying at home. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW researchers are amassing viral samples to build genome sequencing libraries to better understand the behavior of the virus, how it spreads through communities, where the outbreaks come from. Have you had a rapid test? What do you want to know about this screening? Are you concerned about being asymptomatic in your household? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We have UW School of Medicine and Public Health Pathology Professor Dave O'Connor for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Kim now in Madison. Hi, Kim.
Hi. So my question is, I have a couple questions. One, are these specimens like age labeled? Are we seeing more mutations in the older age population? And should we be worried about that? And I haven't seen the actual genetic code for the virus, but what are the chances of one of these mutations becoming like a stock code earlier on in the actual strand?
Sure. So So in terms of age, we don't see any difference in terms of someone's age and their propensity for having viruses that change. The virus seems to behave the same in terms of its biology in people of different ages, though obviously as people age, their immune systems don't work as well, and they have a harder time fighting off the virus. So you see more severe disease in people who are older, but it doesn't seem to have much of an effect on how the virus's sequence changes. And the second question was, how does the virus, what's the likelihood that what's the likelihood that we see a change that makes, for a super strain or something that's really a lot more severe? And that's really unlikely. You know, there's other viruses like HIV and influenza whose viruses, whose genomes evolve a lot faster than this coronavirus. And even there, where you have so much more genetic variation occurring, you don't really see the emergence of super strains. Hmm. So I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Kim, thanks so much for those questions. Jill in Madison is here. Jill, hi.
Good morning. I had a comment. Working in healthcare, like, we do our best to keep everything clean, wipe down doorknobs, lobby chairs, blah, blah, blah. Well, as far as staff, I've had a handful of staff, even like my old manager, who has had a COVID positive family member in the home, like their spouse or children, and they're told to come back to work the next day without a COVID test, as long as they're asymptomatic. And that just scares everybody around, knowing that these organizations are okay because it's a safety concern to patients when we're low staff. So that kind of contradicts everything that we're trying to do.
Jill, thank you for bringing that situation. Dave O'Connor, what do you see there in terms of staffing and being asymptomatic?
Well, I think it's a symptom of a larger problem, which is that the response is completely chaotic and undermanaged. And that sort of thing, frankly, shouldn't be happening. But because you have every organization being left largely on its own to formulate its own policies on how to handle things, and you haven't had strong leadership from the government imposing evidence-based policies about what should and should not be allowed, you have local decision makers who within an organization make decisions like that that are not grounded in good science. And it's a shame that it's happened. And, you know, my hope is that under a Biden administration, you're going to see a resurgence of, policies that are grounded in science. And you're going to see more guardrails put in so that things like that can't happen and shouldn't happen.
We're talking with Dave O'Connor, professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's studying how the coronavirus mutates, what that means for fighting the spread in our communities, and taking your questions as well as 800-642-1234. Dave, on the topic there of policy, what can state public policy do right now as this virus is spreading almost unchecked in Wisconsin? What policy do you think would help stop what is occurring?
Well, we've been thinking about this a lot, especially when it comes to trying to get kids back into schools. And so my colleague Tom Friedrich, Shelby O'Connor, and I have been working on developing, testing regimens that schools could use themselves to try to add an additional layer of security to make it possible for kids to get back into school. And we've encountered some of the challenges that have plagued all the testing programs when we've been doing this. And one of them is that it's similar to what the last caller said, people get tested, then they know that they're positive, and then they're told that they have to stay home for 2 weeks. In a lot of places, that's not possible because of, economic insecurity. I think what we need to do both at the state and federal level is realize that the cost of having the virus spread is enormous, and we need to try to incentivize people to stay home. And, we're increasingly thinking that something like a quarantine universal basic income should be considered, so that if people have a confirmed test, either of themselves or of someone who's in their house, that they would get compensated to stay home during the 2 weeks after that, so that people don't have to choose between doing the right thing and quarantining and being able to eat or being able to, maintain their livelihoods.
Yeah, and so what you're seeing there with that policy of a universal basic income for quarantine, meaning that they could still have income while they are quarantining for those 14 days and being off of work, especially if they don't have benefits where they could use vacation or sick time.
Right. And if you were to, pay someone $15 an hour for 40 hours a week for a 2 week quarantine, that's $1,200 per quarantine. You could imagine paying, someone up to, say, $5,000 per year for four of those events. And it would be expensive, undoubtedly, but you're not comparing the cost of providing such a universal basic income to zero. You're comparing it to the economic loss that's otherwise occurring because the virus is spreading unchecked and kids can't be in school and businesses can't get back to normal. And so I think that we need to think really hard about how we can incentivize people to follow the rule, the rules and policies that have been established. We know that these things work. In early August, Melbourne, Australia, where I lived for a year, and Wisconsin had about the same number of cases, and they have managed to drive their cases down to zero each day, while we now have 7,000 each day. So the policies that work in keeping people at home, keeping people at a distance, wearing masks, these things work in large, complex populations. There just has to be a will, and the government has to be providing the support to make it so that people want to and are able to follow those policies.
I want to look at testing here for a moment. UW-Madison is offering free rapid antigen testing to the community starting today. What are the pluses and minuses of rapid tests?
Well, I think this is still very early on. The biggest plus is that you get an answer really, really fast. So we now know that the virus goes from being barely detectable to being highly contagious within a day or two. And you have a really short window where people are going to be really contagious. And so if you go to a community testing center and you don't get your results back for 4 or 5 days and you act normally during those 4 or 5 days, you're not doing anything to slow down transmission because you don't know whether you're contagious during that period. Conversely, with the antigen test, which gives you an answer in 15 minutes, if you're positive, then you would leave the site knowing that you're positive and knowing that you can take these actions to protect yourself, your family, and others. So that's the biggest plus. The biggest downside of these antigen tests is that they're relatively insensitive compared to conventional PCR tests. And generally, I think that's okay because these less sensitive tests should still pick up the vast majority of people who are highly contagious, but we're still learning about the performance of the assays that are going to be used at the UW testing We don't know yet whether these tests are going to perform exactly the same way in people who are symptomatic, where they seem to work pretty well, and people who are non-symptomatic, who are very early in infection. So getting that data is going to be really, really important.
And these will be spit tests?
No, they're going to be nasal. They're going to be nasal swab tests, but not the ones that scrape your brain, just ones that go into your nose, about an inch.
Dave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dave O'Connor is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up on the cusp of a likely recount in Wisconsin, we take a look at why recounts happen, who asks for them, what outcomes they lead to. It's Recounts after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about election recounts, how they work here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Wisconsin, state law allows for any candidate who lost by less than a percentage point to ask for a recount. If you lose by more than a quarter of a point, you foot the bill. If President Trump wants a recount here, he'll need to pay for it. He lost Wisconsin by about 20,500 votes. Unofficial results, by the by, clerks have until Tuesday to wrap up canvassing. What do you think of recounts? Are they worth it? Do you want one in Wisconsin for the presidential race? What about statewide races? It's 800-642-1234. Deb Otis is a senior research analyst with Fair Vote, a nonpartisan electoral reform advocacy group. Deb, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So we're in the canvassing stage here in Wisconsin. Explain how canvassing works, how results are certified.
Sure. Well, each of the individual precincts canvasses on their own, and then they submit their reports to Central Wisconsin tabulation. And we have to wait until all of these are finished before the recount process can begin. But Wisconsin is one of the states that the nation is watching really closely now, as this is a state where the Trump campaign has already announced they will pursue a recount.
So if there's not a change in the canvas when you check those votes, should you be asking for a recount? Should that campaign be asking for a recount?
Well, Fair Vote just conducted a study on recount outcomes over the last 20 years. And what we found is that it is very rare for a recount to change the outcome. This is what we saw in Wisconsin last cycle in 2016. It was the Jill Stein campaign that requested a recount. And there was almost no change in the votes after the recount. And so this year, I think we can expect there might be a small shift in votes, but very unlikely to make up the full margin by which the Trump campaign is currently trailing.
Yeah, so your group, Fair Vote, analyzed recounts from 2009 to 2019. So looking at that decade, what were your findings? What were your takeaways?
The report was actually 2000 to 2019.
Oh, 2000,
so it's a full
20
years.
Okay.
Yeah, so we looked at all statewide elections over that period, and we found that of more than 5,000 statewide elections, there were only 31 recounts. So it's pretty rare to start with. And of those 31, only 3 of them changed the outcome. So 3 recounts in all of the last 20 years actually changed who was the winner. In every case, the initial margin of victory was less than 0.05%. And we see recounts typically shifting the margins by a couple of hundred votes. So we do get small changes. But in Wisconsin right now, the margin between the two frontrunners is more like 20,000 votes, not a few hundred.
And so when can you officially ask for a recount?
The campaign can ask for a recount after the canvass is complete. And as you said, folks have until the 17th, which is next week, to finish the canvass. And we are expecting the Trump campaign to announce that they're pursuing a recount at that time. They will have until the next business day to request the recount. And then the state is really on the clock to complete that recount within a set amount of time, 13 days.
13 days to do a recount. Georgia is doing a hand recount of its millions of ballots. What does a hand recount entail? What is that distinction?
A hand recount means election officials will look at every single ballot by hand. That's different than an automatic recount, which means the same machines or the same computer would run the tally a second time. So in Georgia, I think we can expect some images of election officials bending over desks, poring over every single ballot to make sure they get the count right.
So they'll be kind of bleary-eyed there, and it will be humans then poring over every ballot.
Yes, and in Georgia, they have just 14 days from when they start their count. So they are also on the clock.
So what is the cost of this? I mean, what are the costs of recounts? What have you found?
Recounts typically cost millions of dollars to do a statewide recount. In Wisconsin, as I believe you mentioned, it looks like the Trump campaign will be on the hook for this bill. If the margin is very close, then the state will pay. But since the margin is not that close this year, the requesting campaign needs to pay for it. In 2016, we saw Jill Stein's campaign request a recount. They paid about $3.5 million in 2016. So we might expect something in that ballpark.
Something in that ballpark around the $3.5 million range for a recount in Wisconsin. Talking with Deb Otis, a senior research analyst with FairVote. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan electoral reform advocacy group. We're discussing recounts, what they mean, how they work, going on the inside of recounts, and what Deb is seeing here in Wisconsin and across the nation with your questions. What do you think about recounts? Are they worthwhile? Do you want there to be a recount in Wisconsin? What and who do you think should pay for it? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Have you seen any trends in recounts, Deb? And by, I mean, are they becoming more frequent from one election to the next? Or are we kind of requesting the same amount? Or are elections becoming so close that recounts are going to become standard practice?
There is one trend that I've noticed, and it's on the legal side. I would not say that recounts are becoming more frequent, but more states are implementing laws to create automatic recounts when the margin is within a certain small amount. In a lot of cases, that's 0.5%. These automatic recount laws started gaining popularity around the 1970s, and more states have adopted it since then. I think recounts are a crucial part of our election system when margins are close. They uphold the value of every vote if an outcome is in doubt. And so I think it's interesting that over the last 20 years, more states have implemented these laws to do automatic recounts instead of asking the campaign to request one. And I think it's appropriate to do those only when the margin is very close, because for an automatic recount, the state taxpayers will be on the hook for the money. So important to do with close margins, but probably not necessary, probably overly expensive if the margins are not so tight.
And for recounts in Wisconsin, is this an automatic through the computers recount, or are we talking about a hand recount here?
Well, we actually don't know yet. Wisconsin state law does not specify. And so once this recount petition has been received, the election administrators will determine how to do that recount. I suspect they're already working hard on creating this process because they know it's coming. In 2016 in Wisconsin, some areas did count by hand, and many of the ballots were recounted via machine.
So during Election Day, there were observers from both parties at the polls watching the ballots take place, observing the process of opening those absentee ballots and feeding them through. Is that allowed during a recount?
Yes, absolutely. Observers may attend, including campaign representatives, legal counsel, media, and others. Observers may view and observe the materials. They may ask questions, but observers may not actually physically handle the ballots and the materials, but they may certainly be there and observe closely.
Let's bring in Lisa, who's joining us from Appleton with a question. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Sure. The number 20,500 keeps on coming up as the number that Biden has won by. But what is the grand total, and is it within that quarter of a percent or whatever you're looking at that the campaign has to pay for? And I guess that's the first question. The second question is, do you make the campaign pay up front? Because in what I see in the past is that the president doesn't pay his bills. So would you ask the money up front if it's something that the campaign is supposed to be paying for because it's over the percentage?
Thank you, Lisa. Great questions. Deb, go ahead.
That is a great question. And yes, some money gets paid up front. You asked about the margin and the total number of votes. There are about 3.3 million votes in Wisconsin. And so you asked if it's within that quarter percent. It's not. The margin is about 0.6% right now. So it is well outside of that margin where they would get it for free. So they will be paying.
They will be paying, and you pay up front. You pay before the work starts, the recount starts.
Yes.
Let's bring in John in West Allis with a question. Hi, John.
Hey, the previous caller had the same question I did about the payment being due up front. My only other comment is, to err is human. So I really think to be on the safe side, I would have, the ballots recounted by the machines, but just simply witnessed. Somebody from the Election Commission, somebody from the Republican Party, someone from the Democratic Party to stand there and watch. I think then the results would be irrefutable.
John, thank you. Yeah, observation, John is saying, so important, especially in the recount process.
I absolutely agree. I think one of the nice things about a recount is that some human intuition can be added into it. You know, we can imagine a type of ballot that a machine would have a hard time reading, but a human would look at it and immediately understand that voter's intent. Like, oh, well, I see that their pen spilled some ink, but they've clearly circled this one and drew an arrow toward it. So that's their choice. And so it's absolutely important when the margins are very close to have a couple of humans supervising this closely.
Okay, because the computers may not quite understand the intent, and it might take us to discern or someone to discern, that human brain to discern, what is going on with that ballot.
Yes, that does not happen to too many ballots.
Okay.
Recounts typically change the results by very small numbers, but even so, we want to uphold the value of every single vote.
Research analyst Deb Otis from the organization Fair Vote. President Trump's campaign is seeking recounts in hopes of dramatically changing the results in several battleground states. We're learning how recounts work as states finalize their results. When are recounts practical? When are they a big waste of time and resources? What do you want to know about their cost and the time it takes to do one? How should they be done, by hand or with a voting machine or both? Will you rest assured about President-elect Joe Biden if there is a recount in your state? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Deb Otis on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Deb Otis. She's a senior research analyst at Fair Vote. That's a nonpartisan election reform group. As states finalize election results, we're learning about the very specific processes around recounts and when they're triggered. George is with us from Monroe. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning. A couple of questions about this recount research. It seems counterintuitive to me that a hand recount will be more accurate than running the ballots through the machine, and certainly far more time-consuming, particularly in Georgia, where they're apparently going to do a hand recount on 7 million votes. I mean, how in the world can anybody think that's more reliable than what's already been done? And my other, do the observers, is there any difference between what observers do if the recount is by hand versus machine-fed?
George, thanks. So what's more accurate, hand or machine, is George's first question.
That's a good question, George. Our research shows that they are about equal. They each shift the margins by these very small percentages, and it's about equal between hand and manual recount. So as you say, a hand recount will take longer. It will be more expensive. The reason to do a hand recount would be if you think something might be wrong with the machines. In Wisconsin and in Georgia, as far as I know, there is no evidence of any mechanical failures like that.
George also wanted to know the role of the observer. Is the role of the observer different based on whether it is a hand count versus a machine recount?
No, the role of the observer is the same. They may be in the room, they may visually inspect the materials, but they may not handle the materials, even if the election administrators are counting by hand.
George, thanks. Rita is with us now in Green Bay. Hi, Rita.
Good morning. It's a great day in Wisconsin. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of thoughts and trying to put them into decent words. First one, can the Electoral College votes change if the recount changes? The other one would be, is I understand the recount and all of the ramifications you're talking about, but who can validate or verify that there aren't double or triple votes or votes given for people who didn't vote, but other people received their ballot at their home and just sent it in, or that a dead voter rolls?
So Rita wants to know, how do you fend off fraud or election fraud through recounts? Starting there with that question, Deb.
Part of the recount process is reconciling the list of voters. And so election administrators will be comparing the ballots they have with the list of who voted and who was eligible to vote. And so they will be looking for issues like that, of course.
And certainly that if there would be, which is very unlikely that it would happen, but if the recount would, say, the winner change, that would, in fact, as Rita mentioned, would change the Electoral College count.
Yes, the Electoral College does not meet and cast their votes until mid-December. And so any changes that we find before then will absolutely change how the state allocates their electors.
Dan in Sun Prairie has a question. Hi, Dan.
Hello. My question is, does a recount look for irregularities? I know Rita kind of touched on that, but I mean, like, we had 200,000 some people on the voter rolls that needed to be looked at that weren't looked at. I mean, will this now be looked at? Should we not have done that prior to this? So there's, you know, the biggest question is, do we look for irregularities in a recount?
Yeah, Dan, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yes. Part of matching up the voter rolls with the stack of ballots that are in possession is part of the recount.
And the terminology here, what is the difference between a recount and an audit?
Well, a recount is recounting all ballots, counting the same set of ballots a second time to check and make sure that the count matches. An audit is something different. Post-election audits count only a small number of ballots, and they use statistical tools to try to say, we have X percent certainty that the count was correct. And so it's a way to do a small partial recount to check whether we got the results right without the cost and time of doing a full recount.
Are audits part of the certification process?
I'm not sure of Wisconsin law on audits.
All right, let's bring in Ben now in Partyville. Hi, Ben.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
So who's to say that the first count wasn't correct and the recount was incorrect? And additionally, if the margins are vastly different, is there any a time where a third recount takes place?
Oh, goodness. So third recounts, has that ever happened, Deb?
It has. Who remembers Florida and the hanging chads? So, yes, it is possible that the recount could also not be correct. And so in Florida, first, there was a statewide electronic machine recount. the recount changed the margins a bit, but not as much as the Gore campaign needed to overtake the Bush campaign. So they requested a hand recount as yet another recount of just a few counties, just the counties where they thought that there had been some irregularities. And so that's absolutely possible. But remember that we are on the clock. The Electoral College meets on December 17th, and most states will be scrambling to complete their results by a week before that, December 8th. That's what's called a safe harbor deadline, when states will want to have all of their legal challenges resolved and all of their counts complete and certified and ready to go. So the recount process cannot go on forever. That's why the Supreme Court stepped in that famous 2000 recount.
Deb Otis, senior research analyst with Fair Vote, a nonprofit, nonpartisan electoral reform group. We're looking at recounts, how they work, the historical context that helps guide us today. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Amanda is joining us in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I had a question. I wanted to know if there is a watermark on each ballot that you can identify the real ballots versus the fraudulent ones, and are they taking that into consideration with identifying that when they do the recount?
Deb, go ahead.
I'm not certain how they'll be handling watermarks on ballots. I was under the impression that there is not any evidence of widespread voter fraud in Wisconsin.
And so when we see the term irregularities, which the Trump campaign has been going after specifically in Wisconsin, what might those irregularities be?
I suspect those will be irregularities with how ballots were marked. There were questions in the past from the Trump campaign about which types of pens or markers could be read by machines. Luckily, the machines can read your pens or your Sharpies or whatever. But I suspect that might be one of the things that folks are looking for. And ballots that get rejected by a machine that come out as unreadable, those would be ones where a human can take a look.
As we start to wrap up here, what are you watching for in the days ahead as these recounts and whether they will happen, what unfolds?
I'm watching for two things. One of them is how many states are doing recounts and how many states need the outcome overturned. Right now, it's looking like Joe Biden has a lead in more states than he needs to win the Electoral College. So even if the Trump campaign could reverse the outcome in Wisconsin, that still might not be enough. So I'll be closely watching which states are needed, which states the Trump campaign is targeting, and how many they'll need to overturn that outcome. The second thing I'll be watching is this safe harbor deadline. This is December 8th, which is a little less than 4 weeks from now. And that is the date by which states, election administrators, and the courts will be scrambling to complete and certify all of the results. So we're on the clock here.
Deb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Deb Otis, a senior research analyst with Fair Vote, a nonprofit, nonpartisan electoral reform advocacy group. Coming up, we talk about what it takes to find a job right now and how to look for and explore new career options during a pandemic. Are you sending out resumes? How is it going? Any leads? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.